Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
Now, the trick about these little diversions is that when you have a cystectomy and you have a urinary diversion, okay, you must pay strict attention to skincare because the kidneys produce urine constantly, continuously. So you're continuously oozing urine. Okay, it's not like a colostomy or an ileostomy where you don't ooze stool all the time. The kidneys make urine constantly. Constantly. They don't ever stop. So what are your interventions? How are you going to help this person? Okay, he's going to have a cystectomy. So pre-op is routine. In other words, the pre-op, you know you're going to give the same medications as you would give for any other surgeries. Demerol, Phenergan, Demerol, Atropine. You know, the medications are the same. He's going to have an IV. You're going to need to draw labs, baseline labs before he goes in. You have to get the consent. You have to find out if he has allergies. You've got to go through the whole list, right? The pre-op checklist is exactly the same for this surgery as for any other surgery. Then you got to prep his bowel. Why are we prepping his bowel? We're not touching his bowel, we're touching his bladder. Well, we're prepping his bowel, and you will see laxatives being given, you'll see soapsuzanum being given. The reason we do this is because we want to make sure there's nothing in the bowel, no stool in the bowel, because we want to make sure it's as flat as possible, as deflated as possible, so that, you know, it's easier to get to the bladder, number one. And number two, we also want to make sure that there's not as a whole lot of stool in there, because, you know, another oopsie could happen. They could accidentally cut the bowel, okay, and cause peritonitis. Okay, so that's what we want to do. I mean, if the bladder's full of, the bowel's full of stool and it's in the way and you're pushing it out of the way and stuff, you could accidentally cause some damage to the person. So that's why we prep the bowel as well. Postoperatively, well, you know, postoperative, the care for, as far as the incision site is concerned is the same. What do you have to do? Remember, this is abdominal surgery. So you've got to think, what's in my abdomen? What is in my abdomen? What is in this cavity? Okay, you got your bladder, you got your kidneys, you got your intestines, yes? Oh, intestines. And remember, when you go into surgery, what do? They give you an anesthetic, yes? They also give you a paralytic. And what's the paralytic? It paralyzes your body. So when I say paralyzes your body, I mean paralyzes the whole body. When they give you a paralytic, it also paralyzes or slows down your abdomen and your intestines. So postoperatively, aside from looking at the incision, you need to do what? Auscultate bowel sounds, right? And you have to auscultate all four quadrants. And you need to auscultate, sometimes you may have to listen up to 5 minutes to make sure that you're actually hearing a bowel sound or not hearing a bowel sound. But you need to auscultate bowel sounds and you need to document that you auscultated. Because he was post-op, because he went to a surgery, and because he got a paralytic, do you have to check his gag reflex before you give him ice? Absolutely. Yes. Just because the abdominal surgery doesn't mean you don't check this. He can still aspirate. Okay, the number one complication post-op is still atelectasis, regardless of the kind of surgery. Then he also got a paralytic and general anesthesia. Then you've got to look at the stoma. Now remember, he's just had a urinary diversion. He just had the bladder taken out. Now he has a urinary diversion. And this little, the two ureters are now coming out onto his stomach. Okay, there will be a stoma. Ultimately, the stoma will shrink. And you may not see anything except a very, very small hole, okay? Sometimes some people still have a little bit of a bumpy there where you can see that there's a stoma. But post-op, whether it's for a urinary diversion, whether it's for colostomy, whether ileostomy, it doesn't matter. If you just had a stoma put in, your nursing responsibility is you must document that you saw that stoma, that you checked the stoma, okay, what it looked like, whether urine was coming out. You need to document everything, the color of it, how high it was, and you got to measure, okay? Was there any swelling around it? Was there any bleeding? Was there any urine coming out, okay? If you have to clean, and he will come out not only with that stoma, but he will come out with a bag attached right to it because, like I said, The kidneys produce urine constantly. So he will have to have a bag. With cystectomies and ureterostomies, it's really important that when you measure the chorea patch, the paste, to put around that stoma, that you really cut, as small a hole as possible to fit around that stoma. Because you do not, absolutely do not want a lot of space between the stoma and the patch and have all that exposed skin. Because remember, urine is what? Acidic, isn't it? Okay, and sometimes it's not acidic, it's alkalinic, but both of them are excoriating. So they'll excoriate your skin up. So just, you've got to make sure that that patch, the space between the stoma and the patch itself, is as narrow as possible. 1/8 of an inch. 1/8 of an inch. That's how small. Very, very close. If you have to take care of the stoma and wash it, is this soap and water is good? Absolutely. Soap and water is fine. Wear gloves. Wear gloves, please. Soap and water is very good. With this particular contraption or this particular bag, you want to empty the bag when it's half full. Do not wait until it's any fuller because the urine can slosh onto the skin. Again, you must take tremendous care to make sure that you're protecting the patient. Okay? This also falls under safe and effective care environment. And there are lots of questions that NCLEX will ask you based upon this. They want to know that you know how to prevent problems from happening. So if you empty the bag when it's half full, there's a very the risks of him excoriating his skin because of the urine sloshing back onto it are minimal, or at least bring it down, okay, a little bit. If you have to change the appliance, which you will have to do, you need to change it in the morning. Obviously, if there's a leak, you're going to change it, the whole thing, regardless of when there's a leak. In other words, you changed it in the morning, okay, it doesn't mean that if you come back later and there's a leak, you go, sorry, can't change it, wait till tomorrow. No, there's a leak, you change it. There's a problem, you change it, right there and then, you take care of it. You want to maintain the acidity of that urine. So how do you maintain the acidity of the urine? Well, you give cranberry juice, right? You give all the acidic, acid, ashy kind of foods because you really want to make sure that that urine stays acid. And you need to watch him for signs and symptoms of urinary tract infection because he can still get one, particularly since there is now a direct route, okay, for bacteria to get in. That stoma is right there on the abdominal wall now. This is a direct route for them to get in. So you need to watch for signs and symptoms of urinary tract infection. You all remember the 7 warning signs of cancer? Sure you do. The word caution. C stands for change in bowel or bladder habits. A is a sore that doesn't heal. U is unusual bleeding or discharge. T is a thickening or a lump on the breast or elsewhere. And the breast, yes, for men too. Okay. I is indigestion or difficulty swallowing. O is an obvious change in a wart or a mole. N is a nagging cough or hoarseness. So those are your 7 warning signs of cancer. Okay, teaching facts regarding cancer. Women, do you all do self-breast exams every month? Women? I know some of you are saying no, and I'm saying why not? You need to do self-breast exams. And you know what? It's perfectly all right for you to play with yourself once a month. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even the Pope will sanction this. So you will not go to hell. Okay? Lightning will not strike you. Self-breast exam once a month. And how do you do it? One arm over the head. Can you do it standing up? Absolutely. Can you do it laying down? Absolutely, you can. Okay, you can do it in the shower. One arm over the head, and then with the other arm, which part of your hand do you use? The palms, the fist, the what? The pads of your fingers, your finger pads. You massage from the outside all the way around, the top outer corner all the way around, and you palpate and you massage it, and what are you feeling for? You're feeling for any unusual lumps or bumps, okay? Now, women, we all got lumps or bumps. Yes, we all have lumps or bumps, traditionally. When is a good time to do your self-breast exam? The best time? 7 days after your menstruation starts, not ends, starts. Day 1 of your cycle is the first day of your menstruation. Count 7 days after that. If you count 7 days after your menstruation has ended, you're now in the proliferative phase. You probably got estrogen up the wazoo. You're going to have bumps. Okay? So 7 days after your menstruation starts, that's when you do your self-breast exam. Okay, men, if you're over 40, you need a digital rectal exam. If you're not over 40 yet, get ready, because on your 40th birthday, you will give yourself a present. You will make an appointment with your doctor. Okay, everyone should have a physical exam every 3 years between the ages of 20 and 40. Okay, after the age of 40, it needs to be annual. For women, you need a pelvic exam every 3 years until the age of 40. And every year after that, after the age of 40, it should be an annual thing. We have pap smears. Again, now with your pap smears for the pelvic, you know, every 3 years until the age of 40. And then after the age of 40, it should be annual. If you're smoking, you need to stop. If you are a sun goddess or god, you need to be very cautious, particularly with our ozone layer going straight down the tubes. It's going to hell in a handbasket. You know, we always used to tell you go out with SPF 15. Do you know what it is now? The recommendation, NCLEX still says SPF 15, but you know what the recommendation is right now with American Cancer Society? 40. Yeah, we're not double, we're 40, 40, SPF 40 if you're going to go out in the sun. Yep, just read that 3 days ago on the internet. Okay, everyone should have a guaiac test every year after the age of 50. Now, what's a guaiac test? You just get a little, you just go in, do a little DRE, right? Get some stool on your finger, on your gloved finger, and then you smear it on the guaiac card. You all know how to do that? You smear it on the card, you put the developer, right? And then you read it to see if there's blood or not. Okay, guys, back to you all again. Women too, we need to do this. Guys, definitely, and women, it's a strong recommendation that you all also have a proctoscopic exam after the age of 50. This is another joyous thing. Okay, if you're not 50 yet, well, don't hold your breath, because you will turn 50. And when you turn 50, you really need a proctoscopic exam. Okay, men, you need to do a testicular self-exam. Now, okay, women, we do self-breast exams. Men, you need to do a TSE. Okay, show of hands, how many guys do a TSE right now? One, there you go. See, he's brave. He admitted. Now, if you guys are like really nervous about doing your own TSC, well, get your wives, get your girlfriends, or your wife and your girlfriend. I mean, you know, get them to do it. It's not a problem. You want to do your testicular self-exam after a warm shower or a bath. You can do it actually in the shower. In the warm shower or the bath. And what you want to do is soap your hand up real good, okay? And then firmly, not gently, firmly take your testicles in your hand and just roll each testicle between your thumb and the fingers of the hands, okay? And just what you're testing for is to make sure that the testicles itself have nice smooth edges and there are no indentations and no lumps or bumps or no pea-sized bumps or anything like that. That's what you have to do. Okay, so just, it needs to be firmly done though. Now, I'm going to tell you, now that we're on the subject of this, one of the questions that NCLEX does ask has to do with Foley catheterization. Remember yesterday I told you that, you know, you should all go back and steal a Foley catheter kit? Yeah. And you can tell them you're stealing it, that way if it makes you feel better, go ahead and do it. But one of the questions that NCLEX loves to ask you is, has to do with catheterization of a man. Yep. Do you take the penis gently or do you take it firmly? You take it firmly, because if you take it gently, he might end up with an erection. And then you're going to have a horrible time passing that Foley in. I had a little student nurse. She was 19 years old. Sweetest, cutest little blonde, blue-eyed little, you know, Miss Cheerleader type. Yes. She had to Foley someone, okay? And now I said, don't start. You can get it all set up, but do not start until I get in. you know, and I'll be with you. Because the old battle axe, you know, they're not going to play any funny games, right? So, anyway, she got it all set up. But apparently what she did was, you know, she said, you have to fold you. So she took his pants off and took his underwear off. And she was so gentle. And she, next thing I knew, she was standing out of the room and her eyes were this big. Okay? What you do? Yeah, he did get an erection. Well, we had to wait a little while before we had to go in. So firmly, okay? I'm not meaning to do, you know, do. But firmly. Don't wrestle with it. Okay. Warning signs regarding testicular self-exam. Okay. Painless swelling. Okay, a lump that's the size of a pea-sized lump. Okay, any fluid accumulation in the scrotum. If you see the scrotum is sort of enlarged and you might think that there's fluid in it, how can you tell whether it's clear fluid or blood? Flashlight. You take a flashlight and you shine, you put it underneath the scrotum, and if you can see that it's translucent, you know, then you know it's fluid, not blood. So the old flashlight trick works real well. So you know all those pen lights that we told you to get? And you thought we wanted you to check pupils. Mm-hmm. Another warning sign is the dull ache in the groin or the lower scrotum or the lower abdomen. Okay, like I said, any pain, and pain is not good. Pain is nature's way of telling you there's something wrong. So if there's pain, you need to do something about it. Okay. And with men, any enlargement or tenderness of the breast. Yes, I did say breast. And why is that? Because women, we produce estrogen primarily, but we also produce progestin. And progestin is a male hormone. It's an androgen. Men, you all primarily produce progesterone or testosterone. I know you all have testosterone fits every so often. Got to go to Home Depot and buy that tool when you have a testosterone fit. I know. Okay. My husband does this all the time. But you produce not only testosterone, you also do produce female hormones. So if you have an enlargement or tenderness of the breast, that could be a warning sign. In point of fact, I had a patient who, he was 38 years old, and he got cancer of the breast. Yeah. So, you know, it's certainly a possibility. Okay, let's talk about breast cancer. All right, everyone, I got everyone's attention. All the men are looking up now. Yes! Self-breast exam is the most important intervention. The most important intervention. Not prevention, but intervention. That's an NCLEX question also. They ask you which of the following is the best prevention of breast cancer. They will put SBE up there. Performing a self-breast exam does not prevent cancer. It is an early detection, so it's an important intervention, so don't get fooled. Read the question carefully. Okay, if self-breast exams prevented cancer, we'd all be running around massaging our breasts all day long. Okay, self-breast exams do not prevent, they're a good intervention. Okay, some of the advanced signs and symptoms of breast cancer include what? Discharge from the nipples, a dimpling of the nipples, that orange peel skin, yes? So remember we talked about having a mammogram done? Well, at the age of 40, you need a baseline mammo. And after that, you should do it every 1 to 2 years after. Now, why do we say 1 to 2? If your initial baseline was negative, what they tell you is that it's okay if you choose, instead of doing it next year, to do it 2 years from now. Now, has every woman in this room had a mammogram done? It is probably the most painful thing. It's extremely painful. They take your breast and squeeze it down to the size of a pancake. It hurts. Yes? And then when you walk out of there, you go, I am deformed for life. Because they mush it down and it hurts. It really does. So I understand when clients of mine or patients of mine tell me, I don't want a mammogram. It hurts. I understand that. Okay? Our job, however, is to just encourage them to go for a mammogram. They're much better today. They're more humane today. It hurts less. I know I just had one done a few months ago. It hurts less, but it still hurts. It still darn hurts. Okay. And they'll squish it this way and this way. Ugh, you are deformed for life when you come out of there. After the age of 50, though, you have no choice. It should be every year. As far as any cancer is concerned, and this is a question that I am going to throw out at you, for any cancer, whether it's liver, whether it's kidneys, whether it's bladder or breast or testicles or prostate, the most definitive diagnosis for any cancer is the biopsy. The biopsy. That is your most definitive diagnostic test, because it's only with the biopsy that they can actually look under a microscope to see if the cells are indeed cancerous or not, if they're well differentiated or poorly differentiated. Okay? If they're poorly differentiated, that's not a good sign. That's what we're looking at. Signs and symptoms of breast cancer. Well, the earliest sign is an abnormal mammography. The second earliest sign is a palpable mass, okay, in the breast. Now, has anyone ever felt a cancerous lump in the breast? It feels like a very hard pea. Normal lumps and bumps that you feel, that's, all women in this world have a little bit of fibrosis, a little bit of fibrotic tissue in our breasts. Those normal, you know, you palpate and you go, oh, ouch, that hurts, and it's a lumpy thing. That's good. That's a good. That's okay. That is not cancerous. A cancerous lump is it's actually hard, and it feels like a hard pea. We talked about advanced signs already. The advanced signs are the nipple retraction and the discharge. Okay, the dimpling of the skin, orange peel skin, and the change in the breast contour. So, therefore, every month when you all are doing your self-breast exams, you know, you're looking at your breast, you should also do this. You should also stand in front of a mirror, and everyone's going, what? No, I can't look at myself naked. Stand in front of the mirror naked from the waist up. Put your hands on your hips. Okay, hands on your hips, and just look in the mirror to make sure that the contours of your breasts are about equal. Now, we all know, women will tell you, we all know that one breast is usually a little bit smaller than the other. But when I'm not talking about that, I'm talking about the contour, okay, that the contour is about equal. There's no bump in, you know, indentation in the breast or anything like that. There's no dimpling, okay, there's no nipple retraction. All right, now I had a patient come up to me because when I was giving her some teaching about nipple retraction, her eyes got real big, and I said, what's the matter? She says, my nipples are always retracted. Well, you know, if that's normal for you, that's normal for you. It's there's not a sign of cancer. So you got to also remember that, you know, some people do have retracted nipples, and so that's normal. Don't get worried about it. So something that you have to reassure them. What's the treatment? Well, my little theory, you know, for cancer is that the tendency, what we tend to do in the medical profession is that we tend to treat any cancer by three methods. We slash, burn, or poison. We slash meaning we cut it out. We burn meaning we irradiate. We poison meaning we give chemotherapy. And you better believe chemo is poison. So slash, burn, or poison, that's what we do. And if you can remember that, okay, it'll help you. So the treatment for breast cancer, radiation, you can have a modified radical mastectomy or you can have a radical mastectomy. Okay, a modified radical mastectomy, they remove the breast and maybe a couple of lymph nodes. When you do a complete radical, then it's the whole breast and all the lymph nodes down that one side, that particular side. What are your nursing interventions then? Your nursing interventions after before the radical mass, okay, before the surgery, is encouragement. Now, there are women, okay, who the loss of a breast to them is the loss of their womanhood, their femininity, because this to them, I mean, because society, we've always said this, you know, that women have breasts and that's what makes them women, and the bigger the better, okay? Yes. So that's been a symbol of womanhood. Okay. When you're 12 or 13 and you get into the puberty stage and you get breast buds and you begin to become a woman, this is like a rite de passage. You know, it's a big, very important thing for women. Okay? So a lot of encouragement before, because they are going to go through, and they have a huge sense of loss and grieving. They're absolutely going to be grieving the loss. It's like the death of a breast. Okay? You're really going to be doing that. Postoperatively, and you do some of your teaching pre-op, okay? You may not be able to do as much preoperatively as postoperatively, because remember, pre-op, they may be in the huge grieving stage. So for you to want to give them information like, oh, you know, after surgery, we're going to be doing these exercises, they really may not want to listen to you. So you'll have to gauge your patient, each patient, okay, as an individual. Now, NCLEX will say to you that you need to do your teaching preoperatively. Fine. That's what NCLEX wants, and that's the ideal world. I'm saying to you that in the real world, you really need to gauge each individual patient on his on or her own merits as to whether you want to, you can get through or not. Okay, sometimes you can't. But postoperatively, you know that this breast is going to be gone, okay? So you need to encourage, and a lot of times the lymph nodes are gone also. And the lymph nodes, as you know, is another part of our circulatory system, and it brings back, it helps circulate back to the heart fluid. If we don't have our lymph nodes, then we end up with edema down that one arm or that one side. Okay, so you need to tell them that postoperatively, and postoperatively you're going to start encouraging just finger movements. When they come out of surgery, that arm is going to be right close to them. Okay, it's going to be adducted, A-D, adducted, okay? By the time they get to go home, though, you're going to want, and the if the drains have come out, okay, once the drains are out, then you tell them to abduct, A-B-duct, okay? So you move away, because at this point in time, you want to encourage the stretching, and you want to discourage the contraction. Remember, when a scar forms, it contracts the skin, yes? So you want to discharge that, and you want to abduct. So you want to tell them, put your arm up on a pillow, you know, play with a rubber ball, reach as much as you can. And in fact, there's a group, a national group for breast cancer survivors called Reach to Recovery. So essentially, when they're in the hospital, they're going to come have Jackson Pratt's. All right, they're going to have Jackson Pratt's in their breast. It's going to be draining. As long as they have the Jackson Pratt's in and it's draining, you adduct. You bring the arm in. Once they're home and the Jackson Pratt's are out, they abduct. Okay? All right, let's talk now about some adverse effects of chemotherapy. Well, this is the poison part, and we remember that chemo is a poison. And we remember that chemo works how? By destroying rapidly growing cells, correct? Rapidly growing cells. So everything that grows fast, replicates quickly, gets destroyed. Cancer cells replicate very quickly. That's why they're poorly differentiated. Okay, they don't have any definitive. If you look at a regular cell, you can see the nucleus, the mitochondria, the Golgi apparatus. You can see the ribosomes. That's well differentiated because you can tell the difference between each. Cancer cells replicate very quickly so that if you look at it under a microscope, you can't tell. Only thing you can tell maybe is a nucleus. But can you tell by the Golgi apparatus, the mitochondria, the ribosomes? Cannot tell. So they're poorly differentiated. Okay? Chemo destroys cancer cells because they're rapidly growing. They also destroy everything in your body that's rapidly growing. And so what's rapidly growing in your body? Your skin, your hair, your mucous membranes, your red blood cells, your white blood cells. These are relatively rapid growing, okay? That's why with chemotherapy you get hair loss, you get stomatitis because your mucous membranes, yet you get ulcerations in your mouth all the way down to your rectum. And this is why people don't want to eat. It hurts, painful, they have less, no sense of taste. Okay? That's why chemotherapy patients become anemic. That's why they're also more susceptible to infections because their white cells are destroyed. So therefore, does that make sense then to you if I say to you that if a person's undergoing chemotherapy, we're going to draw blood to, you're going to get your chemotherapy today, okay, and before we give the next chemotherapy treatment, we're going to draw your blood and we're going to check your HNH and your white cell count before we do another one. Because we want to give your white cell count and your hemoglobin a chance to build itself back up. If you don't do that, then you actually end up killing the person. You know, it used to be, in the good old days when I first started nursing, we gave chemotherapy treatment 3 days in a row, 4 days in a row, 5 days in a row. Okay, and ultimately the patient died. We killed him. We really did. In attempting to save them, because we didn't know any better, you know, in attempting to save them and destroying the cancer cells, we also destroyed every single thing else that was good that he needed. Well, now we're much more humane. We're smarter now. And that's why our survival rate is better now. You know that our survival rate for cancer is much, much better. They're actually, I am one of them. There are people walking around who are survivors of cancer. Okay, so they give you the chemo today, all right? And usually 3 weeks down the road, they'll tell you, come back, we'll draw some blood tests before we schedule the next one. And if your HNH and your white cell count comes back at a fairly decent rate, they will schedule the next one. If not, they won't. They'll say, let's wait again. Okay, and that's a humane way of treating them. It's also a smarter way of treating them. And also remember, we've got better chemotherapy drugs now than we ever had. I mean, the chemotherapy drugs, you know, 15, 20 years ago, made your life a misery. You threw up, boy, all over the place. You're just totally miserable. It's awful. If you think also that cancer drugs, chemotherapy drugs, destroy, is a poison, then if I said to you that it also affects, it's toxic to your heart, to your liver, to your kidneys, would that make sense? Certainly, put any poison in your body and you know it's going to affect your heart, your kidneys, your liver, your lungs, your everything. When you are giving chemotherapy IV, now there's several ways you can do the chemo, and we'll discuss that in a minute. When you're giving it IV, you've got to be very, very, very careful to monitor that IV site because you don't want any extravasation. I mean, that if it does extravasate, which means gets out into the actual tissue itself, that is so destructive. I mean, that will eat up the skin and the muscle and the sub-Q. It will eat up that arm. So extravasation is very, very important to watch for. We also want to talk about some of the chemotherapeutic agents are photosensitive. In other words, you can't have them in the sunlight. Okay. I know of an oncology nurse who does home health. She actually takes the chemotherapeutic agent, she goes to the patient's house and hangs it, okay? And that patient has a Hickman or a Portacath, and she administers it that way. She is so incredibly good with knowing exactly what drugs are photosensitive and what aren't. Now remember, she's got to have the drug in an IV bag in her car, and she's driving. Well, she knows, and she puts them, she protects them not only in the brown plastic bag, she puts them in a paper bag, then in a plastic bag, she protects it very carefully, and then she goes, and then she brings it, puts it in her car. So you have to be careful, and you have to remember that some drugs are very photosensitive, and you've got to monitor that, the vital signs throughout the infusion. So when she goes to the house, when she's giving a chemotherapeutic agent, she goes to the house, she gets a book. She sits down. I mean, if the patient is, you know, sometimes the patient wants to talk, sometimes she doesn't. So she gets the book, she sits down, and she monitors the vital signs, and she does it every 15 minutes. Some people will do it every 5. Obviously, the vital signs start getting a little funny. You need to monitor it more frequently. Okay. Please remember that you'd never, never, never mix. You don't piggyback another medication to your chemotherapeutic drug. Please don't. I saw one person one time trying to hook up a vancomycin to a chemotherapeutic drug, and I went, this is ridiculous, you're going to kill that. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's useless. And also there might be an interaction between the antibiotic and the actual chemotherapeutic drug also. Okay? All right, let's talk about hormonal therapy. Tamoxifen. Well, here's the theory. Tamoxifen is an estrogen-producing or estrogen-stimulating drug. Okay? And I know that we all hear the theory now that if you have too much hormones, that can cause cancer. Okay, understand though there are some cancers that respond to hormones. And that's the reason why we give tamoxifen, okay? We give that to some, in some cancer situations, if the the cancer itself responds to hormones. Progestins, which is a male hormone, leuprolide, all these are hormones. Oops. These are things that we give to patients if the cancer responds to hormones. Now, if the patient is pregnant and then discovers that she has cancer, okay, you can go, she can continue to receive chemotherapy, okay, because the molecules of the chemotherapy are so large they do not cross the placental barrier, so it does not affect the baby. So she can get chemotherapy during her pregnancy. She can also get it, especially if it's breast. She can also get radiation. Of course, we shield the abdomen. Yes, we shield the baby. She can get radiation treatment as well. So if she has cancer while she's pregnant, we can treat it. It does not cross the placental barrier. If, however, she's not pregnant, okay, and she's diagnosed with some form of cancer, she gets the chemotherapeutic treatment, she gets the radiation, she gets fixed, she gets cured, and she says she wants to have children, what you've got to tell them is that they need to delay childbearing for at least 2 years after the chemo treatment has stopped or after the radiation treatment has stopped. Not begun, but stopped. Okay, so say it stops today. This is my last chemo treatment. I now received a clean bill of health. Well, from today forward, I count 2 years before I even think about having a child. All right, so your childbearing needs to be delayed for 2 years. Now, if the mom is pregnant, has cancer, we treat her, she gives birth. She can breastfeed if she's still undergoing chemotherapy. She can breastfeed with either breast with chemotherapy because, again, the molecules are so large, they don't cross the milk barrier. They're so large. So baby is fine. She can, indeed, breastfeed. However, if it's radiation, she cannot breastfeed from the breast that's being irradiated. She can only breastfeed from the other breast. All right? That's an NCLEX question. What I just covered right there, that's an NCLEX focus, actually. Childbearing delayed 2 years after chemo or radiation. You can breastfeed with chemotherapy, both breasts. Radiation, you can only breastfeed from the breast that is not being irradiated. Okay? She can get chemotherapy treatment while she's pregnant, okay, because it does not cross the placental barrier. She can get radiation if it's breast cancer. All right, we shield the stomach. We shield the baby. Let's talk about cancer of the cervix now. We'll talk about the pre-invasive stage and then the invasive stage, and then we'll take a little break. The pre-invasive stage is when the cancer cells are only in the cervix. If they're only in the cervix, then most times these people are asymptomatic. They have no symptoms or signs of cancer at all. And how do we discover this? Pap smear. Okay, so precancerous lesions are discovered by pap smear. Okay, the treatment is cryosurgery or conization. What we do is we go in, again, this is on an outpatient basis, we go in, we freeze that area, okay, and we just remove that particular area of the cervix that has cancer. Okay? Now, I have seen hysterectomies done on patients with localized cancer, localized in the cervix. But that's because it's pretty extensively localized. So they'll go and they'll remove the whole cervix. And just because it's in the reproductive system, they'll go ahead and remove, they'll do a hysterectomy as well. Okay, so I've certainly seen that done as well. If it's an invasive cancer of the cervix, in other words, if it's in the cervix and it's in also the pelvic structures, then you're definitely going to see a complete hysterectomy. And how do we diagnose it? Well, we do an a biopsy, we go do a colposcopy, we stain the cervix, and we take a sample for a biopsy. Okay? If we want to know the degree or the extent of the disease outside the pelvis, then we can do a CAT scan or an MRI to figure that out. So what's the treatment if it's invasive? Well, you've got a couple of ways of treating. Okay, number one we talked about, which was the slash. We talked about cutting it out, right? Conization and hysterectomies. Now let's talk about the burn portion, which is the extensive radiation. So external radiation, rather. This is when you deliver a current to the patient. Okay? Internal radiation is when you put implants in, into the cervix. And usually if they're on internal radiation, we have them, you know, I shouldn't say, it used to be we had them in the hospital during the entire time. Now we still do, but not all the time. Sometimes these patients can go home if they're with it enough that they can follow the directions. The other treatment, of course, is poison, which is chemotherapy, and then we talked about the hysterectomy. Doesn't matter what kind of treatment this patient's getting, whether it's chemo, whether it's radiation, whether it's surgery. Patient's going to be tired. How many of you have had surgery? Weren't you exhausted afterwards? Never mind surgery. How many of you have given birth? You know, you're exhausted afterwards. I mean, after that, you know, forget it. It doesn't matter what form of treatment. That person's going to be tired. They're also going to have nausea and vomiting. They're going to have headaches. They're going to be irritable. They will have skin irritation. The skin will be scaling off. There'll be erythema around, you know, the particular area that the radiation is being administered. And the skin will also be dry, whether it's radiation or chemo, because remember, what does chemo do? Okay, if you remember what chemo does, that really does help you a tremendous amount. We talked about three basic forms, and now let's talk about the two radiation sources. Okay, you've got beam radiation or teletherapy, and you've got brachytherapy. Okay, beam radiation or teletherapy. Tele means far. Okay, so essentially what it is that the source of radiation is far from the tumor site. Let's just say that this projector here is the tumor site. Okay, this is where the tumor is. Now, the radiation source is going to be about here. So it's far from the tumor site. I'm up on the stage and it's far from. That's teletherapy. Okay, so if you remember that tele means far, okay, you'll understand that the source is outside. It has to be far from the patient, so it's outside. In this particular form of treatment, the patient is not radioactive. Okay, so she does not glow in the dark, and her excreta are not radioactive. So she is not radioactive with this particular form. The problem with beam radiation or teletherapy is that it requires the same positioning every time. In other words, the patient has to be laying in exactly the same position. The source has to attack the particular cancer from exactly the same position. Now, in the past, what we had to do is we took this indelible marker, we marked the area, you know, and then we brought the patient there, and they had to move the patient 50 million ways and move the radiation equipment 50 million ways. Well, today in the cancer centers, if you ever get a chance to go to a cancer center, you will be amazed. It's all computerized. Patient lays down in one particular position, okay? They focus the radiation source on the patient, program it in the exact coordinates of the patient and the machine. Type the patient's name in so that every time the patient comes back, all they got to do is type the patient's name in, push a button, boom, there you are, exact coordinates are there. It's wonderful. It's an incredible thing. And that's another reason why our success with treatment of cancer has improved. Okay, so that's teletherapy. It requires the same position every time. The source is far from the patient. It's, in other words, it's not right next to him. Okay, and the patient is not radioactive. Now with brachytherapy, brachy means close. Okay, so if you think about brachytherapy being close, then you understand the source of the radiation is close to the tumor. Okay, in several instances, the source actually comes into continuous contact with the tumor for a certain amount, a specific amount of time. This source is actually inside the patient, and therefore the patient is radioactive. and does pose a threat to others. So his or her excreta are radioactive. You have to dispose of it in a proper fashion. The source of brachytherapy can be a solid or it can be soluble in body fluids. Now we're going to talk about a subcategory of brachytherapy being sealed and unsealed sources. All right, now I need for you to visualize these things. The unsealed source, unsealed meaning it's not encapsulated. So PO, right, if you take a pill, it becomes absorbed into your body. It's unsealed, correct? IV becomes absorbed into your body. That's unsealed. So PO or IV is certainly unsealed. Intracavity, especially iodine-131, where you just dump it right into the particular cavity, like the bladder, okay, that's an unsealed source as well. The waste products are radioactive, but once that radioactive isotope is completely eliminated from your body, neither the patient nor that patient's excreta are radioactive. Now, what do I mean by that? Okay, every single drug in the, every single element in the whole wide world has a half-life. Now, do you all know what a half-life is? Probably not. Okay, because we didn't take, you know, the opportunity to explain it to you in nursing school. A half-life is the amount of time it takes for any given element to decrease its strength by 50%. So let's just say now that we've given you this drug A, okay, and this drug A's half-life is 4 hours, okay? So in 4 hours, I will now be 50% potent than I was 4 hours ago. And in another 4 hours, I will now be 25% potent. Do you understand? I've just decreased by half again. In another 4 hours, I will be 12.5%. In another 4 hours, I will be 6.75%. Do you see? So every 4 hours, I diminish my strength by 50%. That's the half-life. So once, you know, and it usually takes 6 half-lives, okay, for a drug to be completely eliminated from your system. So if the half-life of the drug is 3 days, then it takes certainly longer for it to be completely eliminated from your system, okay? So it's really important that you know that, because then you know when this particular patient is no longer radioactive, okay, as far as you're concerned with a nurse. And also, you know, how to handle the excreta. The sealed source now means that the source of the radiation is encapsulated and is implanted inside or close to the tumor. Okay, a sealed source can be temporary or permanent, and the excreta are not radioactive because it's sealed and it only attacks that particular area right around it. So the excreta and the sealed source are not radioactive. For any implant, any brachytherapy, for any implant, that patient, if she's hospitalized, must have a private room. Okay. Most times, as I said, if a person is undergoing brachytherapy, we do bring them into the hospital. Okay. It's difficult to send them home because you have everybody under the sun that wants to, you know, be in and out of the room. Okay. We need to maintain some privacy for her. So private room and bed rest, certainly, particularly if it's a cervical implant. She cannot get out of bed because we don't want that implant to fall out, okay? We will put a Foley in her. We'll give her stool softness because we don't want her straining. Because if she strains, again, it may pop the cervical implant out. We'll give her bland foods, but we'll give her lots of high-protein foods. Because remember, with chemotherapy, what happens is you lose a lot of weight because you have no appetite. Okay, so we want to give high-protein foods, high-calorie foods, but bland. Head of bed no more than 30 degrees, that's a nice way to go. Okay. And you want to watch for complications. Okay. Now, when I say complications, what I'm saying is vaginal discharge, any dysuria, okay, any hematuria, is there rectal bleeding? Those are complications. And if any of these things occur, you need to tell the doctor. Any foul-smelling vaginal discharge, you need to tell the doctor because she may be coming down with an infection. Okay, she may be coming down with other complications, like maybe we've just, you know, done an oops and hurt the bladder here, or the bowel for that matter. What you've got to tell your patients very, very firmly and very strongly is that they're not to have any sexual intercourse while that cervical implant is in. This is for patients who go home. Okay, though I do have to tell you, I did have a patient who had a cervical implant in, and I'm not an oncology nurse, but I got pulled to an oncology floor. This was years ago. I got pulled to an oncology floor, and I thought, oh, great, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to be glowing in the dark. But I went in to take care of her. Her husband had come in to visit. I went in to take care of her, and I found him in the bed with her, and he was stark naked. And I said, okay, sir, I really don't think it's a good idea that you have sex with your wife at this point in time, because she has an implant in her cervix. So unless you want to irradiate the head of your penis, you know. Sometimes you have to, you know, be very blunt. Okay, so no sexual intercourse while the implant is in. And you have to have, and this is an NCLEX question, in every room of every person that has an implant, you must have a pair of forceps. That is in case that implant falls out. You do not pick up that implant with your bare hands. You don't pick it up with your gloved hands. You don't pick it up, I don't care if you got six pairs of gloves on. You'll use the forcept. You use the forceps, okay? You absolutely use the forceps at all times. Now, we put the Foley in so that we don't have to worry that every time she pees, we have to look and see if the implant fell out. However, every time she has a bowel movement, we got to do the crap patrol, okay? Because it means you got to look through to make sure the implant didn't fall out, okay? Each hospital has wonderful ways of disposing. Most times it's that yellow biohazardous bag that says radioactive on it. So you've got to know how to dispose of linens or excreta, you know, that possibly could be radioactive. Let's move on to surgery. The complications of a hysterectomy. If they have a hysterectomy, sometimes it can be radical and can include the vagina. Remember, if your patient is having a hysterectomy done, that you have to tell her that there's no heavy lifting for at least 6 to 8 weeks after the surgery, right? And heavy lifting means no more than 10 pounds, nothing more than 10 pounds. The other thing you've got to remember also is that if they do a radical hysterectomy, in other words, a total abdominal hysterectomy with a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, which is T-A-H-B-S-O, you'll see that written. If they have that, you need to tell them that they will have not one, but two episodes of menopause. Yes, it's true. The first one's just a trial run, the second one to make sure you got it. Just kidding. No sense of humor, you all. Okay. So we're taking out the ovaries. We're taking out the uterus. When you take out the ovaries, she will undergo biological menopause, particularly if she's only 40 years old. Okay, she will undergo biological menopause. And yes, it's the hot flashes. Yes, it's the crankiness. Yes, it's the everything under the sun that goes with menopause. Okay? Now, once she's gotten over that and mastered that completely, later on in life, when she hits her 50s, she will undergo chronological menopause. So twice she will undergo it. So you need to caution her on this. And right away, she will say, oh, no. After she's gone through the first one, she will say, oh, no. Okay. Nursing care for cancer patients, we talked about this, lots of high protein, high calories, right? And we want to avoid sunlight and exposure. With any form of radioactive therapy, the nurse must follow these principles of time, distance, and shielding. Okay, time meaning the amount of time you spend with a particular patient. In other words, with cancer patients who are undergoing radiation treatment, what you've got to any form of radioactive therapy, it is better for you to actually come in and spend 5 minutes with her, go back out and then come back again later and spend another 5 minutes. That's a total of 10, right? That's better than coming in and spending a full 10 minutes. Okay, so time, distance, and shielding are important things. It's actually better for you to break it up that way. Distance meaning how far away you are from the actual source or from the patient who is the source of radiation. Okay? If you are going to open the door, you know, if you want to ask the patient, what do you want for breakfast, just open the door, poke your head in and say, what do you want for breakfast? You don't have to go right up to her. you know, and say, what do you want for breakfast? So distance is another thing. Shielding is the third, and shielding simply means something or any obstruction that lies between you and the patient. If I put this up, this little plastic sheet up between me and the patient, that's not a whole lot of shielding, correct? If I put this up, which is in this big bundle of papers, that's a little more shielding, correct? If I put the table between me and her, that's even more shielding, okay? And if I put a brick wall up, that's even more shielding, correct? So, bearing that in mind, if the patient has a cervical implant, okay, where would be the best place for you to work with her? From the bottom of the bed or from the top of the bed? Exactly. Okay, because you're following the principles of shielding. Follow? That's an NCLEX question. Okay. Yesterday someone had said, she got questioned on Hodgkin's, on mononucleosis, on all these esoteric diseases. So I said, that's okay, we're going to cover Hodgkin's today. So, Hodgkin's is a malignant tumor of the lymphoid tissues. It's a B lymphocyte problem, not TB. Okay? Hodgkin's disease has to do with the B cells, the B lymphocyte problem. How do you diagnose it? Biopsy. Okay? Biopsy of the lymph, biopsy of the bone, and we can also do a CBC. Signs and symptoms, well, guess what? Night sweats, weight loss, and fever. That's pretty nonspecific, isn't it? Very nonspecific. You've got four stages in Hodgkin's. Number one is when you only one single lymph node is involved. Stage two is when you have two or more lymph nodes on the same side of the diaphragm or of an organ. Stage three is when you have involvement on both sides of the diaphragm or the spleen. And stage four is when there's major involvement of one or more organs or tissues. Obviously, you know the staging. Stage one is not so severe. Stage four, the higher number you go, the more severe the staging is and the more severe the disease process is. The treatment of Hodgkin's includes these four particular categories of drugs. Now, you have in your book, I think somewhere where it mentions MENSA, M-E-N-S-A. Now, and I'm not talking about the Agency for Geniuses, okay, the Organization for Geniuses. MENSA stands for, are you ready? M stands for mustard-based chemotherapy agents. E stands for estrogen. N stands for nitrogen. S stands for steroids. And A stands for antibiotics. So, M, mustard-based drugs, E, estrogen, actually steroids, okay. N stands for nitrogen-based drugs, S is steroids, and A is antibiotics. So that's what the MENSA stands for. When you are taking care of a patient with Hodgkin's, the most important thing you've got to remember is no rectal temps. You may not take a rectal temp on a patient with Hodgkin's because you can actually cause a complication here. So you may not take rectal temps with Hodgkin's diseases. There's a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Hodgkin's lymphoma is the B lymphocyte, and it's not as serious as non-Hodgkin's. Jackie Kennedy Onassis died of non-Hodgkin's, and it came on very quickly, and it was very rapid. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Okay. When you get non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, that's so dangerous because look at where it targets. It targets the bone marrow, which is where your white cells are your stem cells are produced. Okay, and remember, stem cells come out, they're non-differentiated, so a stem cell can become your hair, it can become your eye, it can become your nose, it can become your rectum, it can become your bones, it can become your toes. So stem cells are non-differentiated. They attack the stem cells. Okay, so it attacks the bone marrow, the central nervous system, your GI tract, the breasts, the testes, the liver. Non-Hodgkin's is infinitely more dangerous than Hodgkin's disease. Colorectal cancer. With colorectal cancer, what you've got is a change in your bowels, okay? Ribbon-like stools or tarry, bloody stools. Now remember, again, depends on what is normal. I taught a cancer class one time. Like I said, when I first did this, I'm not an oncology nurse, but I teach nursing and preventive medicine. And I was teaching a class one time, and I was talking about ribbon-like stools. And later on, after the class was over, a student came up to me and she said, "I've always had ribbon-like stools. Does that mean I have cancer?" No. If this is normal for you and you've always had it, then no. But if you've never had it, if you've never had ribbon-like stools, okay, and now you do, ribbon, you know what a ribbon looks like, right? Thin, yes? So if you've never had ribbon-like stools and you have it now, then yeah, now it's a problem. But if you've always had it and that's baseline for you, that's not a problem, okay? Abdominal pain, diarrhea, vomiting, rectal pressure, okay? Obstipation, which means this is more than constipated, you're now obtunded as well, okay? More and more women are getting colorectal cancer today. I mean, when we fought for equality, we didn't mean this. We meant more money. All right. Diagnostic tests, well, we talked about that. DRE, GYX, sigmoids, colonoscopy, and barium enema. And your treatment is / burn and poison. There are some oncological emergencies that can occur. Remember, what we do with chemotherapy and radiation is that we kill everything, right? All fast-growing cells. Well, if we kill, and in the past, a lot of people used to die from sepsis because we would give chemotherapy treatments 3 days in a row, 5 days in a row, 7 days in a row, or 2 weeks worth of chemotherapy and then stop, okay? And a lot of people would die from complications of sepsis because, remember, our white cell count, we just killed them all out. Okay, so our immune function is down, white blood cells count is down. It's a very frequent cause of death in cancer patients. Okay, sepsis can also cause disseminated intravascular coagulation, DIC, because you're killing the platelets, okay? You're killing everything, you're killing platelets, and so the body system wants to produce more platelets, so the platelets that are being produced in a hurry are even more thicker than the normal platelets that we just killed. So what we end up with is a situation of bleeding and clotting at the same time. That's disseminated intravascular coagulation. Now, if your patient comes down with DIC, and DIC can occur also with what? Postpartum. Okay, can occur with women after giving birth. So if you see DIC, then the treatment, be prepared to give heparin first, because the concept is let us stop the clotting first, okay? Because we don't want too many clots. Let's stop the clotting first, and then we'll deal with, then we'll give the clotting factors later. Okay. There's another emergency called the superior vena cava syndrome, SVC. Now remember, your superior vena cava drains all the blood from your head, your right shoulder and your right arm into your right atrium, right? So superior vena cava syndrome occurs when you have a tumor that's pushing on the superior vena cava, and this prevents drainage of blood from the head to the heart. So guess what happens if you have now a backup of blood into your head? You have increased intracranial pressure, yes? You now have severe headaches and you may stroke out. So that's superior vena cava syndrome, and it is an emergency. You can also see something called syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone. Now, SIADH, okay, let's shift gears a little bit. Go to your endocrine system. What is the master gland of your body? The pituitary, okay. What does the pituitary produce? Well, go through your whole list, and you will remember that the posterior pituitary produces also antidiuretic hormone, correct? And oxytocin, right? So antidiuretic hormone is produced by your pituitary. Your pituitary sits in your brain. So if I told you that anytime you have a blunt trauma to your brain, anytime you have cancer or tumor in your brain, look for SIADH, because it may happen. Diabetes insipidus, it may happen, okay? Antidiuretic hormone is the hormone that prevents you from, your kidneys produce about 180 gallons of urine a day. Now, if we were to pee 180 gallons a day, we would just live in the bathroom. Yes? So antidiuretic hormone is the hormone that actually reabsorbs the water so that you don't pee 100 gallons a day. You go, you know, maybe 2,500 cc's. Okay? So if we didn't have antidiuretic hormone, we'd be in the bathroom. So you want to watch for syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, SIADH. And this can occur from cancer of the lung or the brain. You want to watch for water intoxication, particularly if your ADH isn't working, because you're going to be just filled with water. Okay? So you want to watch for that. Weight gain can happen. Now, inappropriate can mean too much ADH or can mean too little. Okay, so if you've got too much and you're retaining, and if you've got too little, it means you're peeing. So remember, SIADH can be both sides, can be too much or too little. So you want to watch for water intoxication. You want to watch for weight gain and personality changes. Why? Personality changes, your hormones are out of whack. Remember what happens, ladies, when your hormones get out of whack? Every month. Seizure activity can occur, and why is that? Again, there's pressure on the brain. So when you have pressure on the brain, and we'll cover that when we cover the brain later, a coma can occur. I'm going to ask you to speak into the mic so everyone can hear your question.
I just need the definition of MENSA, definition of each.
M stands for mustard-based drugs. E stands for estrogen. N stands for nitrogen-based drugs. S stands for steroids, all the other steroids, okay? And A stands for antibiotics. And if you look at your cancer treatments, you've got chemotherapeutic agents that are mustard-based, you've got estrogen-based, right, tamoxifen that we utilize. N, you've got drugs that are nitrogen-based. S is steroids, we give prednisone a lot to people who have cancer. And A is antibiotics, because we also do give streptomycin and high drugs like that. I mean, very, very strong drugs like that to patients who have cancer. Okay, any more questions? All right, let's move on to laryngeal cancer. Since we are on cancer, let's go ahead and finish it. Cancer. With cancer, you've got progressive hoarseness. Progressive hoarseness. Okay? You have a difficulty swallowing or a lump in the throat. There's a burning sensation in the throat when drinking hot liquids. Laryngeal cancer, progressive hoarseness, difficulty swallowing, a lump in the throat. There's a burning sensation in the throat when drinking hot liquids. Okay, and a persistent sore throat. Let me tell you what really brings people in with laryngeal cancer. Difficulty swallowing. That's what brings them in. The progressive hoarseness, you know, the persistent sore throat, they just figure, I got a bug that I just can't shake. But that inability to swallow, when you can't eat, that's a problem. Okay, so that's what brings them in more than anything else. What are the interventions for laryngeal cancer? Laryngectomy. Now, there are two types of laryngectomies. There's a partial, and in a partial laryngectomy, only part of the vocal cord is removed, so you still have a voice postoperatively. And there's total. With total laryngectomy, the entire voice box is removed. You have a loss of your sense of smell, okay, you have a loss of your speech, you have a loss of it all, okay? And you have a permanent stoma with your laryngectomy. All right, now, what do you have to do? Preoperatively, you've got to teach your patient about alternative methods of communication, because even with a partial, we ask them not to talk immediately post-op. So even with a partial, even though they have a voice, we ask them, don't talk, rest your voice box, and we have to develop an alternative method of communication, whether it be by writing or signs or, you know, whatever. But you need to establish that before he goes into surgery, right? Not after, before he goes in. So that when he comes out, he knows, okay, now I gotta write. Now I gotta rest my voice. Postoperatively is not a good time to be teaching. So, pre-op care, routine medications. You're gonna give atropine. What does atropine do? Dries you up. Atropine is an anticholinergic, so it dries you up, okay? There is a question in NCLEX floating around that asks, why do you give atropine? Look for, here's the answer. You give atropine for its anticholinergic effects. That's the answer. Because atropine is an anticholinergic. Now, if you do not know what a cholinergic substance does and what an anticholinergic substance does, you need to go back and look up your neurological system again. You have to understand about sympathetic nervous system, the parasympathetic, I know you all hate this, and the parasympathetic nervous system, you hate it, but it's good, you need to know it, and it'll help you in your nursing. It really will. Okay, we talked about the communication mode that, you know, before you have to talk, discuss with him an alternative form of communication. The other thing preoperatively you can tell him also is that he can obtain an artificial larynx and he can learn esophageal speech, that he will get a speech therapist, that you will arrange, you know, that the hospital, whatever, will arrange for a speech therapist for him. And you've got to understand that sometimes you've got to initiate the communication or the contact with the speech therapist. Okay? Postoperatively, he's now got a bandage around his neck. All right? Now, you've got to check for hemorrhaging. Is there any hemorrhaging? Well, what you want to do is with your gloved hand, you want to slide your hand around the back of the neck and feel if there's any moisture or see if there's any moisture or blood or whatever. He will be in a semi-Fowler's position. Okay? Semi-Fowler's position. The other thing, another way that you can detect whether he is hemorrhaging or not is frequent swallowing. If he tends to be swallowing an awful lot, then he could be bleeding, and that's why he's swallowing. He's bleeding right here from the incision site, and that's why. You want to check for atelectasis. Okay, remember, number one complication of surgery, regardless of the surgery, is still atelectasis. Okay, so that's what you got to check for, and check also for pneumonia. Remember, if he had a total laryngectomy, he's going to have a stoma. If he has a stoma, now it doesn't matter whether it's a laryngectomy that he has it or whether he had to have an emergency trach. Anytime he's got a stoma up here in his trach, whether it's from, you know, like I said, cancer, where you remove the larynx or whether it's just that he had an emergency trach, regardless, anytime he has a stoma, you've got to know how to take care of it. Okay, so you want to avoid water around the area. Please. Aerosols and sprays are a no-no. So you need to tell him, okay, or if it's a female patient, her, to avoid hairsprays. You want to tell him and his wife to avoid hairsprays, any kind of aerosol. You know, right now we have everything that's an aerosol, right? Air fresheners that are aerosols, yes? We've got every Lysols and aerosol. We have all kinds of things that are aerosols. So you want to avoid aerosols and sprays, particularly right around that area. Particularly right around the trach, because, you know, it gets in, and that's very, very irritating. Not to mention who knows what carcinogens are in it. You also have to let them know that he's going to, at the very beginning, require very frequent suctioning. He's going to have to learn how to suction himself, okay? He's going to require more frequent suctioning immediately post-op than later, but he's still going to require suctioning. So your job post-operatively is you've got to know you're going to have to suction him. Okay, remember, it stops here. It can't come out anymore. It stops here. So you've got to suction to keep that trachea nice and patent. Because, you, again, complication, atelectasis, pneumonia. Okay, you need to do your job to make sure that he doesn't encounter any complications at all. You're also going to teach him the TCDB. What's TCDB? Turn, cough, deep, breathe, right? You're going to teach him that basic nursing. You know, when I went to nursing school 100 years ago, we learned TCDB right after surgery, and guess what? We're still doing it today, and it's a wonderful thing. Turn, cough, deep breathe. There's some things about nursing that just don't change. You know why? Because they're standard, they work, and they're simple, and just there's no reason to change it. Do not reinvent the wheel. Turn, cough, deep breathe. When do you teach them about the coughing? Pre-op, exactly. All this is pre-op teaching. You teach him about coughing pre-op. You tell him pre-op, yes, I will be bothering you. Every 2 hours, I'm going to turn you. I'm going to make you cough. I'm going to make you take deep breaths. You tell him this pre-operatively so that he knows that afterwards, when you tell him to do it, okay, and when you get to him and say, okay, I need for you to cough, he will understand why. He's no surprise to him. You do not want surprises on this particular patient. Because he has a trach, and now remember the portion of your respiratory system that humidifies the air that you breathe is your nasal oropharynx. Okay, this portion right here, that's the portion that humidifies your air. Okay, remember we bypassed it now. We got a trach. So we no longer have that particular area that humidifies the air. So now we've got to give him, we've got to humidify it. Okay, So that's, teach him that too. And also teach him that oral hygiene is very important. Okay. Very important. And you need to know that too. So you need to go in and clean his mouth out very frequently. And why is that? Again, it's dry. Okay. So you've got to teach him all of that. Teach him also that he will probably, and not probably, he will have a HemoVac. Now, HemoVac works just like a Jackson Pratt. Now, remember with a Jackson Pratt or a HemoVac, it works how? It has to be deflated. It works by negative, right? Negative suction. So it has to be deflated. So in other words, if you go in to see a patient who has a HemoVac or a Jackson Pratt, and the Jackson Pratt is fully inflated and the HemoVac is fully inflated, then you know it's not working. Okay, that's not the way it should be. The HemoVac needs to be pushed flat. Jackson Pratt needs to be squeezed so that there's an indentation, because that's how it works. So tell him there will be a HemoVac and explain that to him. Why does he have a HemoVac? To drain any additional fluids that might be there, because why? You don't want it going into his lungs. Okay, and that's just a preventive measure. You can praise the doctors for that. Okay. We talked about a different form of communication and the speech therapist. If by any chance this person, anyone with a trach, has a need for CPR, you are not going to do CPR mouth to mouth, are you? It's called mouth to stoma. Yes. Oh, I see faces here. Mouth to stoma. Okay. We talked about suctioning, the need for frequent suctioning. What is your job as a nurse? Well, your job as a nurse, when you are doing any kind of suction, whether it's NT suctioning or ET suctioning or trach suctioning, whatever kind of suctioning you're doing, your job is this. Okay, you've got to assess the secretions and you've got to assess the respiratory status. So basically, you need to auscultate lungs before you suction. Okay, before you suction. Hyperoxygenate before you suction. Suction. Okay, hyperoxygenate, and listen again. All right? That is you're only going to do one pass, of course. If you're going to do more than one pass, remember it's a sterile technique. You wait till you've completed all your suctioning attempts, and then you auscultate after. But that's the methodology. All right? You're listening to the lungs first. You want to know, you want to get your baseline. You want to know, okay, what does it sound like? Pretty junky? All right. I need to suction him. Okay, then you hyperoxygenate him, because remember what happens when you suction. You're pulling the oxygen out as well. Okay, so then you suction him, all right? And then you hyperoxygenate after suctioning. Okay, so it's very important. And you also need to document. You need to document, what do the secretions look like? Were they tenacious? In other words, were they thick? Okay, were they liquid? What color were they? Were they white, yellow, brown? What color were the secretions? Okay, was there an odor to it? Or was there not an odor to it? Okay, what was his respiratory status? In other words, you know, he needed suctioning. Why? Because he was huffing and puffing at 28 breaths a minute, 32 breaths a minute, and after suctioning, he calmed down. You know, so what was his respiratory status before and after?
Please move to the next section of the lecture series.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.